Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kona e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora, this is part of a series of podcasts and video documentaries on the New Zealand Wars, which also include episodes on the Northern War and the First Taranaki War.
You can find them wherever you found this podcast, or just search for New Zealand Wars on the RNZ website.
E mihi ana te ngākau ki a koutou. Big thank you to New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, ko William Ray tēnei.
Kia ora, ko mihi ngārangi Forbes aho. This is the final episode in a three-part series, The New Zealand Wars, The Story of Tainui. In our previous episode, we heard how the war for Waikato began.
We started with the crossing of the Mangatawhiri.
In total, there were about 18,000 troops on the Crown side involved in the invasion of Waikato.
Then the Battle of Rangiriri.
The cannons firing from the river, as well as the troops coming on the land, had never been encountered in the Waikato before.
And finally, the tragedy of Rangiauwhia.
It's much, much more than just being a war, a fight, a battle. This is a pahuatanga. It's an atrocity.
This episode, we'll hear how the war ended.
Rewi Maniapoto must have been in shock late in the summer of 1864 as he made his way towards Mangatauturi, a sacred mountain of Waikato. Days earlier, he'd been leading the defence of Pātiranga.
Those defences had been Rewi's masterpiece, the strongest fortifications ever seen in Aotearoa. The British had shelled his pa on and off for 3 days, and Māori had described it as Momo Poru, a waste of gunpowder.
But then the news arrived. The British had snuck around Pātiranga in the night, attacking Rangiauwhia, burning houses and killing women, old people and children.
Rewi and his followers rushed back, but it was too late. The best they could do was to make a stand against the British at an old pa on the Haereni Ridge. Here's Ngāti Maniapoto historian Kawhia Murahi. Remember, when he talks about Rewi Maniapoto, he calls him Manga.
Obviously, after Rangiauwhia, there are a lot of emotions running very high. All of the kingitanga people heard what had happened, and all of those along the coast as well. And our people really needed to vent, I believe, themselves and do something quite significant. So a stand was made at Haereni.
General Cameron's artillery pounded the Haereni Ridge while Rewi fought side by side with Wiramu Tamihana, the kingmaker.
Yeah, this was a pivotal moment in Tamihana's life. He was a hardcore Christian and deeply committed to pacifism.
Yeah, I mean, we're well into the Waikato War here, and until Rangiauwhia, he hadn't actually taken up arms and fought personally.
They call him the peacemaker as well as the kingmaker. He later said,
"For the first time my hand struck, my anger being great about my dead, murdered and burnt with fire at the Rangiauwhia."
It wasn't very well thought through. A lot of our people were wounded, a number of them shot. And in fact, Manga's brother was wounded there. A few years later, he died from his wounds. So it was an opportunistic attempt to, I think, let off steam and to show the colonial forces that what they had done was not acceptable.
Eventually, though, Rewi and Tamihana were forced to retreat. They watched on as the British looted and burned Rangiawhia for the second time. They did the same at Kihikihi, Rewi Maniapoto's hometown. Tamihana rushed back to his pā on Maunga Tautari, just in case it was the next target of the British. Rewi stayed around Rangiawhia to gather his people, then travelled east to catch up with Tamihana a couple of days later.
The mission was to go and see, link up with Wirimu Tamihana, make a plan for phase two or the last phase of the defence.
Rewi had scouts out all over the area. They were gathering intelligence on the British forces, information which would be critical for planning the next phase of the war. As one of these scouts walked out of the bush, Rewi waved him over to make his report.
Maunga received word that a group, a large contingent from Tūhoe, Tūwharetoa and Raukawa Te Kohera had gathered at and were wanting to engage with him to discuss some important matters.
Rewi must have been worried about delaying his meeting with Wirimu Tamihana, but these were important allies of the Kingitanga. They come all the way from Te Uriwera to support their allies in Waikato. They had to be heard out.
And they really wanted to engage directly with the troops. They didn't want to take their weapons back all the way to Tūhoe without being fired. Te Pairata was there from Ngāti Te Kohera. He was adamant that he was adamant that this is the time and the place.
Rewi's own followers agreed. They were furious at the attack on their villages, and they suggested holding their ground at a pā called Orako.
The Battle of Orako will become one of the most famous in the history of Aotearoa.
Yeah, definitely. It was the subject of New Zealand's first ever locally produced film all the way back in 1925. It's called Rewi's Last Stand.
Let us go by the fortune of war. If we are to die, let us die in battle.
But of course, Rewi never wanted to make a stand at Orako.
You have to understand why that's the case. This is his land. He knows the lay of the land. He knows where the good places are and the not good places are, you know. Second thing is that wasn't his mission. He was determined to meet with Wirimu Tamihana and to do something less opportunistic but more systematic. Tūhoe had a number of matakite with them, seers, to help with their decision-making. The seers had seen, you know, great things to happen. It's going to be a great war. We're going to win this particular engagement. He said, well, we shall see.
So Rewi and his people went with Tūhoe to Orako.
But from early on, it was clear Rewi had been right. This wasn't the place to fight the British, and General Cameron was quick to seize on the strategic mistake.
Well, the colonial and imperial troops arrived on the scene before the pā was finished. Not only was the pā not finished, the logistical situation was absolutely dire because they hadn't been able to secure sufficient ammunition, absolutely insufficient water. The only food they had was potatoes and kumara, pumpkins, and the peaches from the peach trees. I can't remember if it's actually in season. But very little kai. So your ability to withstand a multi-day siege is very limited.
What's more, the way the land was shaped around Orako made it easy for the British to surround the pā. They set up artillery positions to pound the unfinished trenches.
So unfortunately, all of these lemons came into a fate where they all came together to create a disastrous tactical situation.
Worse, it wasn't just fighting men at Ōrākau. You know, up to a third of the people inside the pā were women and children. Here's Ngāti Apakura historian Dr. Tom Raw. He's also the Associate Professor of Indigenous Studies at Waikato University.
We're often asked, how come there were children in the pā? And we have this family story again of our tupuna Ripeka with her baby in swaddling, not even a toddler, taking her baby into the pā. And we're asked, how come? And we say, Rangi Aofia was the example. It was supposed to be safe. Where's safe for my baby? The only safe place for my baby is in my arms.
The siege lasted 3 days.
Yeah, the defenders, they ran out of food and water and finally ammunition. But on the pā were peach trees and they used peach stones as bullets.
I actually heard one story from a historian that sometimes the British soldiers would get hit by a shot and they'd think, oh, I'm dead.
That was a peach stone.
Yeah, they'd open their vest and they'd have a big bruise because they got hit by a peach stone and not by a lead bullet.
Just tricking.
Yeah. Eventually, General Cameron signals a ceasefire. He sent a message demanding that Rewi surrender.
The reply that Rewi sent back is one of the most famous quotes in Māori history, possibly New Zealand history. You see it everywhere. It's on T-shirts and caps and hats. It's at all the protest rallies. Friend, we will fight on forever and ever and ever. For Kawhia Murahi, this is a phrase which still has really deep meaning.
It symbolises something better than just the words themselves. Back then it meant, you know, we are physically at war with you and we will not surrender. I think if we look at that term now, it is a legacy entrenched in the notion of struggle for your rights, struggle for the treaty, for the whakaputanga, struggle for your humanity, to ensure that our grandchildren will no longer have to contend with being slaves, constitutional slaves, legislative slaves of a regime that is not of our making, that does not represent who we are, that does not articulate our dreams and aspirations into the future, and that is a struggle for our freedom, and it's an ongoing struggle.
When a second message came from General Cameron suggesting the women and children, you know, leave the pā, go somewhere safe, there was another famous response, this one from a young noble woman, Ahumai Te Pairata.
Ki te mate ngā tāne, me mate hoki ngā wahine, me ngā tamariki!
If the men die, the women and children must also die. Pretty full on.
Mm. The defenders fought back 2 more British assaults, but by this point, everyone could see the situation was hopeless. Like we said, they'd run out of ammunition, water, food.
On the last day, 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. They made a break through the defensive lines. They moved in disciplined fashion. They did not run screaming and yelling. They broke through the lines to the south of the position. It's a 5-kilometre walk to the Punya River. And it is in that, over that 5 kilometres that many of our people were killed.
I mean, there are just so many stories from this escape. Kafia Murahi himself takes his name from one of the tupuna who was killed running from Orako. Murahi is a shortened form of the phrase Te Mura o Te Ahi, which means in the heat of the battle.
During the retreat from the pā, Pōneke and his son Nikiti, or my tupuna, they were with the formation. And Nikiti, the son, he was shot. He fell back. His wounds, he couldn't get up and walk and continue to move forward. His father, Pōneke, who was in the formation, saw his son fall. So he pulled back and went to his son. And he could see him bleeding, and there's nothing much else that he could do for him. The cavalry and the soldiers were advancing at some pace, and he knew that, you know, there's no way out for him. So Pōneke began to sing his puruporaki to his son, and they were both killed there. Luckily, young Nikiti had a son at the time of the war, of the battle, and his name was Remi. So a number of years after the battle, Remi's tupuna, Rewi, called him in, and he changed his name from Remi Pōneke to Te Murahi, in memory of the battle and Te Mura o Te Ahi, where they fell. His parents fell.
And it wasn't just men who were shot running from Orako. Te Ahu Mai Pairata, the one who gave that famous quote, she was shot and wounded 4 times.
And she was one of the lucky ones because she made it out alive, because plenty of the others were murdered. It's a big word, murdered, but, you know, some of the accounts are is that they were hacking them down as they were hiding in the caves and swamps and things.
Mm. Gustavus von Tempsky, we talked about last episode, talks about this in quite heroic terms, sort of talking about how he and his men did so well in pursuing these people.
They began to drop under fire very fast. Our wind and stamina began to tell after the first 3 miles. Many a lagger was shot after having given us the last desperate shot of his barrel. For 6 miles we followed our prey. The last natives were 3 or 4 trotting along the top of a distant ridge. Signs of a declining day and a bugle sounding the return made us relinquish further pursuit.
But you have other accounts, again, from colonial sources. Like here's how one newspaper correspondent reported what happened after Orako.
Women, many women slaughtered and many children slain are amongst the trophies of Orako. And civilization in pursuit, or as it returned from the chase, amused itself by shooting the wounded barbarians as they lay on the ground.
Which brings us back to where we began our story.
Yeah, with Rewi Maniapoto standing on the bank of the Punia River, watching the survivors drag themselves out of the water.
You've got to think, hey, even then he must have known that this was just the beginning of many hard years for his people and the kingitanga.
Mm.
Here's New Zealand war historian Vincent O'Malley again.
The destruction almost overnight of that thriving Tainui economy that up until 1863 had been feeding the settlers of Auckland, that's just eliminated, and the survivors of the war retreat south of the Punia River into the King Country district. The population there doubles almost overnight, and there's huge deprivation. There are reports of people dying of starvation in the mid-1860s. So that has massive ramifications.
Very, very tough times. Manuputu in the hinterland, uplands of the Central King Country. There's not too much big, long flats where you could grow lots of kai as in the Waikato. Very different terrain. So the challenges were very difficult for Manuputu to ensure that they were looking after their kin from the north.
And while the kingitanga were sheltering in the lands of Ngāti Maniapoto, the Crown wasn't wasting any time. More than 1.2 million acres of Waikato land was confiscated in the aftermath of this war.
And, yeah, that land wasn't just taken from tribes who had fought against the Crown, but those who had stayed neutral, and, remarkably, even from those who supported the Crown's war effort.
I think we still live with the consequences of it today in so many ways. I think you can see it in the socioeconomic statistics for Māori communities throughout the Waikato region. In 1900, the government published an official return of Māori rendered landless as a result of confiscation, and there are over 3,000 names on that list, and behind each name would be a whānau story of dispossession, of exile, of poverty, and the consequences of that resonate over generations, really.
The war had a deep personal impact on the leaders of kingitanga. Tom Law says Wiremu Tarapipipi Tamihana knew that New Zealand had changed forever.
He realised that this was indeed a great war for New Zealand. It wasn't just about this place and this space. The colonial powers, the colonists, it was their intent to take over the country, and they didn't care to do it by fair means. They would do it by foul means. And Wiremu Tarapipipi, he recognised that finally when he saw what happened here. I feel sorry for the man.
He was really heartbroken by the Waikato War and, you know, died prematurely a few years later, and spent the last few years of his life petitioning for an inquiry into what had unfolded. He sought justice. He sought the return of the confiscated lands, and he was bewildered at being accused of being a man of war when he was a man of peace. And so, you know, there's a great tragedy in his story as well, but there's also lots of people can learn from Wiremu Tamihana, who's an inspirational figure.
And on the Pākehā side, you know, General Duncan Cameron had won this war, supposedly, but he was also really unhappy.
He becomes really increasingly disillusioned with the war and with what his troops have been asked to do. And I think, like a lot of the ordinary men themselves, are asking themselves, why should we be fighting and dying in this war for the benefit of settlers in New Zealand? So they come to see it as a land grab, basically, that they benefit from in no way whatsoever. And they wondered why the settlers in New Zealand shouldn't be doing their own dirty work for themselves.
After Ōrākau, General Cameron clearly had lost heart in what was proving to be a very challenging, worrying time for him.
As for Kingi Tāwhiao, he faced a lifetime of struggle. Waikato Tainui historian Rahui Papa says he had to lead a people in exile, managing the tensions between, you know, various iwi and hapu crammed together in the lands of Ngāti Maniapoto. I mean, that just would have been tough times. They would have been refugees, really, in somebody else's land.
And it took Tāwhiao a while to get the sort of mind shift out of the doldrums of the mind and into a place where they could actually discuss where are we trekking to from here. So the Raupatu became the single most devastating impact on the Kingitanga and Waikato, but it also became the single most rallying point for the psyche and the people of the Kingitanga going forward. So the search for redress happened. Coming back after 1881, Tawhiao laid his weapons down at Pirongia in front of Gilbert Meir, the then magistrate at the time, really bringing the Waikato chapter of the wars to an end. He came back and started to establish Manamotuhake pathways, including the Pokai, including a bank at Maunga Tautari, including his own communications through Te Hokioi, including his own parliament at Maunga Akawa. You know, all of those things were coming about because of Manamotuhake pathway.
So Governor Grey was never able to achieve his aim of destroying the Kingitanga. I mean, it survives to this day, right?
Yeah. I mean, my grandmother was a Kingite. She's a staunch supporter. Actually, all of my nannies and uncles and korals and the rest of them have been all Waikato and all Maniapoto. And I never really understood what the loyalty was about. Mm. And sometimes I feel a bit shy, actually, with the way that I have perceived the Kingitanga. When I now know this history of it, you can see why there's such a staunch alliance with it still to this day.
We survived despite everything that should have meant that we were lost. Late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a hopelessness. But the Kingitanga, people like King Mauta, Princess Te Puia, and other leaders pulled us up by our bootstraps and said, don't give in. As one of Tawhiao's saying is, ko te atua tōku piringa, ka puta ka ora. As God is my refuge, I will survive.
But I mean, even though Grey hadn't completely destroyed the Kingitanga, which was, you know, his objective, he did have enough military supremacy to begin doing a whole lot of stuff which would really change Māori life in New Zealand forever.
The Waikato War ends in 1864. Within a year of that, you've got the Native Land Court established. 2 years after that, you get the Native School System established. So one strips Māori of their land and the other of their language, and those wouldn't have been possible without the Waikato War, and we live with the consequences of that today, still.
The Kingitanga kept searching for justice for more than 100 years. There were plenty of victories and disappointments all along the way.
But in 1995, there was a milestone. The people of Waikato Tainui and the Crown signed a deed of settlement. It included a formal apology for the Crown's actions in the Waikato War and for unjustly branding the Kingitanga as rebels.
Tainui have harboured grievances for 130 years. Today's apology took just 4 minutes.
The Waikato Rapatu Claim Settlement Bill, 1995.
Presented by the Prime Minister, the bill already has the support of Parliament and now finally is signed by the Queen in triplicate. It reads, the Crown expresses its profound regret and apologises unreservedly for the loss of lives because of the hostilities arising from its invasion. It goes on, the Crown acknowledges that the...
So that settlement also included $170 million in compensation for the confiscated land.
Yeah, but according to the Waitangi Tribunal report, the actual value of that land as it was then would have been worth about $12 billion when the iwi settled in 1995.
So just doing some rough maths, that's like 2% of the land's actual estimated value.
Less than. But, you know, anyone who's worked in the treaty space knows that there's no real choice. It's not really a negotiation. It's just kind of what's on the table.
It wasn't just Waikato who lost their lands. As we speak now, Ngāti Maniapoto are still looking forward to their apology and settlement from the Crown.
Yeah, so Ngāti Maniapoto was punished for providing refuge to the kingitanga, and the iwi was also labelled rebels, and through legislation lost a lot of their whenua too. As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, my grandmother's grandfather was listed as a landless Maniapoto Māori in 1900.
Mm.
So the generations that followed, like my grandmother and all her siblings, they had pretty much nothing. Yeah, they lived pretty modest lives in poverty, week to week, you know, that kind of stuff.
And look, like I said at the start of the podcast, I grew up in Kirikiriroa in Hamilton, and that city's built on land which was confiscated from Waikato Tainui during this war. And look, I didn't know much about the Waikato War when I was growing up. It's only recently I've started having chats with my Māori friends about it. One thing that my Māori mate said is that he felt a bit of whakamā, a bit of shame that he didn't already know this stuff and that I was having to tell him because I'd, you know, been doing the research for the show.
I hear the same from Pākehā, you know, who feel a bit whakamā because they might live on land that was, you know, given to settlers at a cheap price and the rest of it. And I always just say to people, you know, this is our past and it's warts and all. And if we address some of those big issues like disparities between Māori, Pākehā, and even more bluntly, racism, you know, we will be able to kind of get along and move forward more quickly. One thing I feel really optimistic about is how, as a country, we're learning te reo again. Because that's one thing also when you lose your land, you lose your reo. My grandmother spoke Māori, but none of her children spoke Māori. And it's a real painful part of them not having their reo or having it kind of whacked out of them. So I feel like we're turning the corner on that too. Here at RNZ, they're doing a lot of work on the reo. Yeah, and telling these stories, William, you know, like, honestly, this is, if I ever get an opportunity to do a series like this again, I'll be very lucky, but this is a career highlight.
I mean, it was really special because you did all the interviews for the show, and I loved being able to hear them. I think we're going to put up all of the full interviews in the podcast feed so everyone can hear everything that I had to say, because there was so much stuff in there that a Pākehā audience has not heard before. Listening to Tom Roa, actually, I find it really fascinating how conciliatory he is.
We're brought up with these stories. And what amazes me is that our parents, our tūpuna, continue to insist, utua te kino ki te pai. Pay back bad with good. That Christian message of, if someone strikes you seven times, turn your cheek. Seven times. Well, it's very difficult.
For Kawhia Murahi, speaking from Ōrākau, the Waikato War is a story of values.
We talk about courage. We talk about selflessness. We talk about compassion, determination, perseverance, integrity, honour. These things, to me, represent what Ōrākau is about.
And for Brad Totorewa, who is standing amid the pā defences at Rangiriri, it's a story of unity.
The kingitanga was built on unification. And so I acknowledge all the other tribes that came through, from Taranaki, Ngāti Ranginui, Tū Hoi, Tū Wharetoa, all those iwi that participated here. And our view of it today is exactly the same thing. This is a movement of unification.
It's really difficult to decide how to end this series. We had quite a conversation about it, actually.
We had a big wānanga.
Yeah. But in the end, we decided to leave the final word to a woman whose name literally means the pain.
It kind of made sense once we had thought about the fact that she had lived her whole life as one of the consequences of the Waikato War. She was named after the pain of it. Mamai Takere, a woman whose whole identity is linked to the suffering still felt 160 years later, and who has a message for all of us.
Your ancestors killed mine. And that spirit still hovers over me. It's still a shadow there. But I have to move on, and so do you. I now have a mixed whakapapa genealogy, which is Japanese, which is Pākehā. And I'm very proud of that. And I want a safe country for my mokopuna. I want somewhere safe where they can grow up and not be subjected to all this again. It is my responsibility as their great-grandmother to try to make a change. There are Pākehā in this country that want the same as I do. Help us. Let's work together and make these changes. Take ownership of what your tūpuna did. And don't tell me that, you know, that's old hash, that's old stories. Let's move on. Forget about that. I'll never forget about it. And I don't think you should either. Take responsibility. And by taking responsibility, then we can move forward.
Tēnā koutou e whakarongo mai ana. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating.
5-star rating.
A review on Apple Podcasts. That's the biggest thing you can do to help more people find the show.
I mean, you can always just also tell a friend, just say, hey, you should listen to this. Or you could post a link to the podcast on social media. All that stuff really helps.
You can find tons of other awesome podcasts on the RNZ website, including lots more podcasts about New Zealand history.
Yeah, and actually, if you want to hear more about how Māori today deal with life in the shadow of colonisation, I'd really recommend checking out He Kākano Aho. It's a show that sort of challenges the assumption that growing up as Māori in a big city means being disconnected from your culture, and I found it super interesting.
Yeah, New Zealand Walls, The Stories of Tainui is a co-production by RNZ, Aotearoa Media Collective and Great Southern Television, with the support of New Zealand On Air. E mihi ana te ngākau ki a koutou katoa. It's presented and produced by me, Mihi Ngārangi Forbes.
And also by me, William Ray. Our executive producer is Tim Watkin, and our sound engineer is William Saunders. Our voice actors were Tim Watkin, James Kane, and Jim Moriarty.
Hei tāwhiri atu kawe wariwari. We also heard help from RNZ's Shannon Haunui Thompson and Justin Gregory.
And from Annabelle Leithmather, Mahanga Pihama, and Cameron Bennett from Great Southern Television. Special thanks this episode to Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision and to the Hayward Whānau for providing that clip of Riwi's Last Stand for us to use.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.